Good morning, Chris.
How you doing?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Good. I'm very good.
You hit me with something yesterday. Well, a couple of things. The first one is that you sent me a message about empathy engines.
Oh, I know,
You
those.
threw me for a loop.
Just because we hadn't talked about it, or just the fact that that other tech existed.
That other tech existed and people could opt out of options that we want to opt in on.
I know, eh? I love the I kind of dig that it exists. I remember seeing, so the idea that somehow glasses can mask this kind of disruptive technology that you can wear is actually meant, how do I go at this in a different route? So I remember seeing it was a post on Insta or something, and it was all about a fork that when it's used to eat noodles. So I'm playing also off of the, me going for noodles yesterday. And as I'm sort of sitting in front of the bowl, slurping up the ramen and all the great stuff that's in the bowl, I'm thinking back to this post. I think I saw it on Insta somewhere on socials. It's a fork that as you scoop up the noodles and you go to kind of give it a good slurp, the sound of the slurp is processed by a small computer in the handle of the fork, and it has a it emits a sound that masks out the slurping. So I've seen a couple different versions of this, but it basically is a disruptive white noise generator to mask your, I guess, embarrassing slurping sounds. Now, from my understanding, there's some cultures that as you eat, you consume the foods, as you slurp the noodles, it's kind of part of the process. It's socially acceptable to make these noises. So on one hand, I thought, well, this is entirely, I guess anyone could feel embarrassed by their eating noises, whatever. But this also just makes me think of a little bit of kind of the wrong reason for kind of like cultural norms to be inserted into other cultural norms. So if it's okay, I actually really like having the freedom of making as much noise as I want to as I eat. I have noticed that some people are not as comfortable with those sounds, but when I saw the fork, I thought to myself, that's a really interesting disruptive tool. I mean, I've heard of, there's other cool ones too, like if on the theme of cutlery, I've seen the there's a spoon that was developed for individuals that have hand tremors. And it, I don't know what it's called, but the device that you can attach to your, I think you have one, you can attach your mobile device to it, and it's a Steadicam cradle. So it always keeps the, your image centered and it not kind of rattly around. Imagine that same tech, but in a spoon for someone that has tremors that they can't hold the spoon stable enough to actually consume their food. I thought that is really cool because in the actual handle of the spoon, there's a vibration device, there's a sort of like a hinge on the actual what is this, what is the round part of a spoon called? That's got to be called, would you call that the bowl? I'll call it the bowl until I find out otherwise. But there's, so you got the handle and the, what do you think that's called? What's your guess?
I have no idea. I
But
just
it's,
didn't even think it would have a name, just because the spoon is the spoon. It's the handle with the round part at the end to collect your food.
I love this. I have no idea. I'm sure there's an actual name for the bowl part of the spoon. But the
Okay.
bowl part of the spoon always stays plain, so it never tips over. So even if your hand was shaking or rattling, or and it's sort of like I might be remembering an upgrade to it, but even so, you have the idea. You know how you can do this thing with the pencil and it makes it always seem like it's like you're bending the pencil? Well, I think even if you rattle your arm up and down like this, I think that the spoon itself even floats in the handle somehow. So I like the idea of people create, and this is kind of like
I found it.
you, what, which one? The
The
spoon?
what it's called.
What the name of the actual, the bowl?
So a spoon is a utensil consisting of a small, shallow bowl, okay, also known as a head. Oval or round at the end of a handle.
There we go. The handle and the head, or the bowl. Cool. So that I like, you know, despite the these glasses kind of being a disruptor of something that we thought was a good idea, still believe is a good idea. I love that someone's like, their iteration is in direct opposition of what we think is important. Like the thing that we were trying to connect, someone is like, nah, you don't want to be easily identified. You don't want to have, make it any simpler for people to sort of get a look at you and to figure you out. Last thing I want to throw in, I remember maybe it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, there was this surge in individuals that, I think it was a scarf. It was some article of clothing that Hollywood stars, actors were wearing. And what happened was when people, and you know what, this could be fake, could be totally fake, but the tech that was embedded in the scarf, when someone tried to take a picture of the individual wearing the scarf, it flash flooded or it disrupted the actual image. So you had individuals wearing these scarves that wanted to avoid the paparazzi. So I kind of dig. That's just more fascinating. It's backstory connected, but it's fascinating to me when you have these point counterpoint innovations. Sometimes they actually are in communication with each other. Sometimes it's just an individual innovation, so they're on different simultaneous paths. And every once in a while, someone says, wow, this kind of counterpoints this. That's really cool. So
I'm stuck. Okay, so it's funny because as you're talking about this, I write down technology saving the day and ruining the day.
Yeah.
It's crazy that your idea of the spoon with like the gyro on it to make
sure. That's it, the gyroscope. Yeah, cool. Gyro. Thanks.
That exists.
Yeah.
That is friggin' amazing. That is what technology is supposed to be doing, man. It's supposed to be evening the playing field for people. Like, imagine someone with tremors who's like used to enjoy soup. Like, I, for one, am not a big fan of soup, but someone who loved soup and then couldn't eat it anymore because of that. Mm-hmm. And then this iteration on the spoon, this innovation allows you to do that again. Holy, I feel like a bad word was going to come out there.
That was close, but I'm feeling you. That was.
But it's like that one would have been worth it because that is so awesome. That's the stuff I love about humanity. That's amazing. That's cool. Totally amazing.
Cool stuff, eh?
It takes me back to my exoskeleton. And did I ever talk about the exoskeleton on the podcast? I don't know if I have or not. But
well, I've seen them. Before I go too deep, I mean, I've seen. You do your story and I'll do the one that kind of that sticks in my mind too.
Well, the thing with me is I'm fascinated that somebody could build a suit that you could wear or parts of a suit that you could wear and connect to your body that would allow you to do things that you wouldn't normally be able to do. Like for example, you know, running. Or let's keep it simple, walking. So people who lose the use of their legs for one reason or another and at different percentages, like, you know, they lose like 50% of the power so that they can't walk as far or whatever. They strap on these things to their legs, this like skeleton that sits on top of your leg, mm-hmm, and it's controlled with motors and stuff. And you can let it do some of the work. So, okay, so your body only functions 50% capacity for walking, but you know, then you could have a monitor connected to you that will tell you, okay, you don't want to be at 50% because that means you're giving 100% of your energy. So drop it to 25, mm-hmm, and then let the exoskeleton grab the other 75% and take over. And you can still go for your walks and you can still do what you normally do and you can feel alive again instead of feeling deficient, right? So I would love parts that I could put on me to allow me to do things. Like, so running or walking, you know, you do that a few times and you feel sore. Well, if you could put something on your knee that would be smart enough to protect or to allow you to move in a way that's more efficient, then you could save your knee and that pain for another day. Like, I'm in. Like, I'm in. Sign me up. Who's going to throw what on me and let me try it? Mm-hmm. Right? As I get older and less popular, like with my family and stuff, they don't care if I do these things. So just let me do it and let me enjoy that. There's something about that that brings me, it makes me happy that somebody's out there using science and technology and engineering and all that good stuff to help people's quality of life improve. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm blown away by the spoon. How did I not know that existed?
Don't know, man. You kind of go, it's one of those spaces that as other people explore, it doesn't always make it to, like, it doesn't always make to, I think, here's, I think sometimes that interesting element of innovation. So that stuff can be kind of released and it can completely hibernate in plain view. So that makes, you know what I mean? Like, people kind of just push out iteration after iteration after iteration. They're not, maybe the marketing machine doesn't scoop it up. Maybe it doesn't get enough likes or hits. Maybe the people are just like, you know what? Someone's going to find this when they need it. Someone's going to plug in, you know, I need a spoon to eat cereal with because my hand shakes too much. And boom, there's free advertisement. Someone's going to find that. So it's interesting. I like your statement. Like, how did you not know this or kind of notice this? Because on the same factor, it's really cool that you didn't, right? You know, we've talked about this before on the cast, the idea of, you know, despite our sort of depth in use of digital tools, when somebody brings something to mind that either A, we hadn't considered, or B, just weren't paying attention to, that's pretty cool. It's like finding, it's the same feeling that other individuals have when we'll say teachers, right, or just people in general, when they sort of have that discovery of that thing online that really feels like they've discovered it, despite the fact, you know, maybe other people have noticed it too. People saying, you know, recalling a tweet from a year ago about something that feels like a brand new discovery to that individual. So these, I like that. I also like the fact that it didn't come across your feed.
Awesome.
Because it also, in some ways, doesn't it almost like replenish or rejuvenate your sort of interest in the internet to a degree as well?
100%.
As a really cool space to actually discover, like, things that you can discover.
Speaking of discovery.
Yes.
So the other day, somebody tweeted out a question about, you know, PD and how you get PD and what counts as PD. Mm-hmm. And I responded with, you know, YouTube videos and podcasts, particularly what new ones and ones outside the realm of education. Mm. And I was thinking about that response to them. And again, what brings me joy is making that fresh connection that's never been made before. That brings me so much joy. And I think this week I've been in, we just ended the second week of summer school.
Yeah, man.
This was my joy this week, is that what you're talking about, that freshness of discovering something on the internet that you've not encountered before, and then making a connection that is just new and fresh. Like, it is total brain nutrients, to establish these new connections. Like, Hey, so-and-so is talking about this topic or concept. I can totally see that in my context as an educator with respect to the way I function with, like, my colleagues and my students and my parents. Mm-hmm. And man, oh man. So why am I talking about this? I'm talking about this because what is awesome for me is when I stumble upon a podcast or a YouTube video that has nothing, absolutely nothing to do with my job.
Yes.
Then looking at, okay, why am I interested in what I'm hearing or seeing? What does it do? What's it doing for me? And then can I make a connection? And normally the connection these days has been the connection to trying to improve myself, to make myself a better person in terms of like more efficient or more aware or more mindful, and taking that, because I truly believe the foundation of education is the connection with people. And I'm not saying anything new here, but what I'm saying is there are so many layers on top of that that people forget that people are supposed to be there for people, because we get paid. Like, I guarantee you, if, you know, money was not an issue and I remained a teacher, the curriculum would just be tossed to the side until I built connections with kids that then they were open to learning. They're like, hey, okay, I trust you. We've known each other for a little bit now, but I'm here every day. So what are we going to do? And it's like, right on, grab that folder over there. And let's start talking about some stuff that maybe you could discover, and we can build, we can establish a foundation, and we can build on that. And you can leave me understanding certain things and how to think critically and research and all that good stuff that comes from the curriculum. Mm-hmm. But I really think, and what I'm doing, like, people are tweeting and Facebooking about these books that they're reading to become better at this or better at that in the classroom. And that's cool. But I'm not going to read that book if I'm stuck on how to become a better person. I'm just not, because yeah. I read that book and nothing's going to happen if I can't communicate effectively with the kid in my room. You know, like lately I've been doing a lot of work around assessment and evaluation. And I have to tell you, the deeper I dig, the more interesting it becomes, because I'm learning new things and I'm making connections to the way I operate as a teacher. But all that stuff is great, right? Self-reflection, peer assessment, success criteria, learning goals, all that stuff is great. But if I have a kid in my class that's like, I'm starving and I don't want to be here, nobody loves me, none of that means anything to them. None of me applying any of that stuff that I know is going to mean anything, because their whole learning profile is upside down. So thumbs up to the people that are out there reading these great books about whatever concept or topic. I'm not there right now. Right now, aside from my work with the assessment and evaluation stuff for a wicked presentation that I'm kind of putting together, my focus is on watching stuff and hearing stuff that's going to get me in a better headspace, so that when I go back to school, I'm feeling good about me and I have space and time to help other people feel good about themselves. So I tweet out, this is what I'm doing. The response is, well, can you refer me to some stuff? Sure I can, but it's going to hit you over the head because it's going to have nothing to do with education. You know, like it's not, it doesn't. And so then your head's going to be tilted sideways. You're going to be looking at me like, what the hell is all this? Well, you asked me to show you and tell you. So then, you know, I gently respond. Well, there's the general response, because if I get too specific, it's going to make no sense to them. We have no relationship, so they're not going to get me. Right. But I'm not going to not respond to something that tweaks me and makes me feel like I have something to say. So having said all that, second week, excuse me, of summer school comes to an end. And I'm finally awake to the summer, because you and I had been, I think this week we went back and forth about, you know, there are people out there feeling anxiety because the structure that they have from the school year is gone. So they're like, I feel like I'm kind of floating in space. I feel like my time is not, you know, being used properly, or I'm not engaged in certain things. And after I read that and saw that, you and I kind of did a little exchange. I'm feeling more awake for the summer now. I feel like the first 2 weeks I was doing stuff, but I just felt like that lack of structure. And so now my structure for the remaining, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks before my head turns into school gear again, is to enjoy the no structure and have one or two things every day to focus my head on. Because I say one or two, because the other 8 slots in my head is going to go to family. Because I have found, I said this to my wife at the end of the first week, I said, I'm dying here. And she's like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, between, you know, all the ad hoc stuff that the kids want to do, I'm doing some PD. Like I'm doing some PD. So I'm trying to like put together a presentation and I'm reading about stuff. And so every time I sit down to do something, the kids are like, hey dad, so-and-so just called, can we go swimming at so-and-so's? And I'm like, yeah, of course we can. So I find, you know, I sit down to like get in the groove of my learning or of my work. And then something pops up in the periphery that realistically is more important than the work that I'm trying to do. So I get taken away. So that was interesting tension, right? Because my wife's looking at me like, hey, it's the summertime. You know, you're going to have to find your time for that stuff. You chose to do it. So find the time. And I'm like, I'm trying to steal time here and there. And then I heard something on a podcast about being selfish and about if you're going to grind and you're going to do your thing and you still want to respect the time and energy of the people around you, then you got to make sacrifices, which was awesome because it totally refocused me. So what happened for the tail end of the work I was doing was I got up earlier to work on it, or I stayed up later and I worked on it. And it's those things, right? That's what I'm talking about being a better person, being in a better headspace. I was for a couple of days trying to steal time from the family to do my thing. And it was a simple podcast episode. You know, it doesn't matter who it is or who's doing the podcast. It was the message. And the message was about, you know, doing your thing. But hey, if you're surrounded by other people that you care for, then you can't always grab time away from that. You're going to have to make sacrifices. And then the sacrifices lead to a feeling of satisfaction when things are done that makes you want to do it again. But there's no easy way out. Anyway, I don't know how I got to that, but that's my PD.
We came off spoons for that. We came off the disruptive technologies that disrupt technologies. maybe I didn't need to say that twice. Basically, technologies disrupt things that you wouldn't necessarily want to be disruptive, like those glasses, the anti-empathy engines. Yeah.
I want to shift gears again.
Do it.
I want you to take us to the staff room, the school staff room, because you sent me a message.
Yeah.
About, well, do you want to jump in and kind of introduce the idea and then we can go with it?
Yeah. So it's just
because the reason why I say that is because you talked about, and I don't know if I fully understand what you were talking about, but you were talking about how you were reading something in a book. And so you took the picture, a screenshot of the inside the book, mm-hmm. showing me, and I read it. And when I read what you had posted to me, I don't know if I saw it the same way that you had intended for me to take it. But basically, it takes us back to the staff room where you engage in conversations and discussions that maybe you don't agree with or make you feel uncomfortable and start having you think in a different way about the students that you're looking at in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the heart of it. So I'm reading a book right now. It's by this dude, Christopher Emden. And I should look up the title so I hit it right. But it's the title is For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood. And it's it, one of the parts that kind of jumped out at me was there's lots of parts. I'm nowhere near finished the book. It's going to take me a little while to kind of go through it and process and kind of create my thinking around it, which for me, creating my thinking around it always involves kind of drawing or writing, kind of like synthesizing it somewhere else. So one of the parts that jumped out at me, and you and I had existed in this, but from a different, you ever seen one of those movies where the narrative that the audience is presented, kind of they do this thing where they present, as far as the big story goes, they present a through line of the narrative according to the perspective of very specific characters. And then sometimes, they flip it and show the exact same scene, but from someone that was just kind of like a secondary character in that actual original scene. Hate to drop this, but like right now, the family's just right into Harry Potter movies, and we watched yesterday Prisoner of Azkaban. And in one of the scenes there, Hermione has this thing that she can reverse time. So it creates a duplicate of themselves, and they're able to go back through certain scenes in the movie. And their perspective, it's like reflective practice. This is kind of cool. Their perspective as they're viewing the scene that they already lived through is from a different, it's kind of at 180 degrees to where they were. So they get to watch themselves in their own scenes. And I like it when I'm caught between the two of those things, as in someone gives me an idea that I'm aware, I become aware that, yeah, you know what, I've talked about this before. And I think I kind of had a lock on it, but I didn't consider this new perspective, right? And having that dissonance of the ideas. But that's what it is. It's like, that sudden, the sudden cold water in your thinking, that sort of like shakeup of like, wow, I wasn't looking at it from that perspective. Or maybe I wasn't seeing the big enough impact because I was so focused on this one little thing happening in front of me. When you and I visited this idea, it was from the point of view of sitting in a staff room and not necessarily being able to feeling like you can connect into conversations or situations that are happening in the staff room. I think we're on one part just observing what it's like to be in the staff room. I think on one part talking about our own compulsions as to whether or not we actually want to engage in conversations. But I don't know if we stepped into wholly into where this book got me thinking was when we do choose to step into these conversations, what is it that we're repping when we're in those conversations? And this particular book in this particular page sets up the argument that we're practicing our points of view without even knowing it. And we're practicing, for better or for worse, where our points of view are going to go when we're not even aware of it. So the conversations that happen in the staff room that talk about those kids. So you talk about the kids at a distance. As soon as you start to create any sort of harmonious discussion around that, you're kind of infecting yourself with a point of view. So when you move away from that conversation, you are more likely to sort of bring to mind your opinion from that point of view than thinking to yourself, like, what's really going on here? Like, how could it be different? Am I actually, like, it's hard to question your point of view when you're being confronted with it. So in this particular, I guess I could go back to what I sent you. Did I text you that, or I think I sent it on, did I send it on Twitter? Send it on Twitter? I think so.
I think it was Twitter. I was muted there.
No, it's all good. So just, what did I send you? Oh yeah, so it was actually, so it's from the author's point of view, talking about that the everyday, so the everyday conversations that we have, so I'm paraphrasing here, it was a chunk, but basically the everyday conversations that we had, the author was sort of reflecting on that where he got hung up on was the idea that if we're only looking at students as teachable or unteachable, it creates just a very, very unfortunate and also powerful black or white, kind of like it becomes polemic. So it's really hard to exist when a kid doesn't exist in either of the, doesn't exist in one camp over the other. I found for myself, it's like, well, what if the kid doesn't exist in either kind of camp clearly? And so it was the last statement of the last two sentences that kind of rocked me. We spent our lunch meetings and after school professional development sessions trying to one up each other with stories about how challenging our students were. We spent so much time and energy exaggerating these stories that we became distracted from our initial goal to affect change. So, you know, I feel like somewhere around the statement of like practice what you preach is kind of a starting point with this. But I think what happens is what you practice is what you will preach, maybe becomes the more powerful thing here. And in this particular context of this book, the larger picture of this book, it is a, it's opening up the discussion around a lot of the practices of individuals, specifically white folks, and white folks specifically as in individuals who look white, but it also sets up a really interesting context about other individuals that are supporting a system that inherently privileges white people. So in that case, it wouldn't necessarily need to be someone with white skin that would be considered a white folk. It would just be someone that's in alignment with the thinking that created a system that disempowers individuals who aren't white. It's a good book. It's definitely a good book. It's got me kind of scattered in my thinking. It's going to take a while for me to kind of take pieces that I think this is what I specifically want to action next, but it's opening up, the 180. It's giving me definitely different views on some of the conversations and places that I've been in so far. You received it differently than that?
I was stuck on the one-upping, which I dislike that a lot.
Dislike that it exists?
I dislike that some people, their focus is not on, their focus is on, well, I've got to top this. And and when I think of it in the context of a staff room or on a staff, don't get me wrong, I love a good story. I've got some good stories and there are other people who have some good stories. And I hope that people haven't seen my storytelling as one-upping, because if they have, then I need to think about the situation, because sometimes I have been in situations where I will one-up somebody just because I can't stand what they're doing, or I'm mirroring what they're doing and I guess I'm having fun with it. But when I'm not doing that, and you come into the room and you say, this just happened to me, and they're like, well, you think that's such and such? Let me tell you such and such. And it's not a one-off. That's the person's way of operating. You see them do it all the time, no matter what the context is, whether you're talking about cars, shoes, hats, kids, pedagogy. They're always looking. They've got something better, something bigger. I don't want to spend my time with people like that. And I have found, you know, that lends itself well to not wanting to go to a staff room or wanting to spend time with anybody. So when I read the excerpt that you sent me, my head went right to the one-upping, and, you know, making the connection to those times where you're sitting down with your division and you're supposed to be focused on a certain task with respect to the work that you're doing, let's say moderating a performance task that, you know, three classes did. And then you get stuck on a periphery point where you talk about, well, when this kid was doing this activity, this is what I was seeing. And then someone responds with, well, you think that's bad? When my kids were doing it, this kid was doing this. And then next thing you know, you're completely off track. You're not moderating the student work to get an understanding for their understanding. Now you're telling war stories of the performance task while the kids were doing it. And it's then like, for me, I just shake my head like, okay, we only have a certain amount of time and this is how we're spending it. Like, what a waste of time. And then I'm like, I don't want to spend time doing that. So I'm just not going to come and sit with you people anymore. Like, anyway, that's what I got stuck on. And it reminded me of the reasons why, you know, I stopped going to the staff room. And there are one or two people in the room that don't do that. Right. But the room is overtaken by the majority of people. So if the majority of people are sitting quietly eating their lunch, then that's what it's going to be typically. But if you've got some people who come into the room and they operate the same way and they're loud and they have things to say and sometimes not positive, I could get swept up by that. And I don't want to. Some days I do. Some days I have a lot to say that's not positive. But most of the time, I'm trying to remember where I am and what I'm there for, right? And I don't know about other teachers, but what gets on my shoulders is the stress of what the outcome is supposed to be. So I remember working at a very challenging school many years ago. And when I was there, we had a principal that understood the challenges of the building. And so the focus was on student learning, but there was an understanding that there was so much we could control at the school and so much we couldn't control outside of the school. And this leader, because he was a leader, this leader believed more that in this building, we have to make these connections. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. These kids are coming with nothing, and we have to give them something. And before we can fill their heads with knowledge and have them learn skills and practice skills, we have to connect. We have to make sure that they're ready to learn, which means we have to love them, and we have to feed them, and we have to model for them, and we have to coach them. Like, these things must happen. And everybody on staff at that time fully understood, and we bought into that. Well, what happened was then, you know, the next year he was moved to another school and we had another administrator. This administrator, perhaps this administrator believed the same things as the last person, but this administrator didn't express them. They were not explicitly expressed. Therefore, you know, we were confused. There was a lack of trust between leadership and teachers. There was a lack of trust. And so we were always kind of like flip-flopping between landing on what this person wanted with what the last person created in terms of the culture of the building. And what ended up happening is things fell apart because the situation we were in wasn't being acknowledged. The only thing that was being acknowledged is these kids are here. EQAO scores need to rise. Here's our focus, and here's our mandate, our vision, our focus, what we're going to improve upon. This is how we're going to do it. And there was no acknowledgement of the peripheral stuff that is actually more important than all that student learning that's not going to happen right if nobody's feeling good about what they're doing, in my opinion. And so, you know, I've seen both sides. I've worked in buildings where it needs to be acknowledged, the profile of that building. And I'm saying this, and I'm going to say this out loud for people to hear. I'm not saying that we ignore the academics. What I'm saying is you need to build the trust and the relationships in order to move forward with the academics. In some schools, kids are going to succeed. Well, kids are going to generally succeed no matter what. In some schools, they come with everything they need. All then they need is the teacher to teach and to model, you know, the things that we want them to take with them when they leave. But in other schools, kids come with nothing. Their cup is empty. Nobody loves them. Nobody treats them well. Nobody teaches them anything outside of the building. They don't want to talk about math all day. They want to talk about life. They want to talk about you. They want to get to know you. They want you to get to know them. They want to feel cared for. I think those things are worth talking about. And I think those things need to happen, because when they don't happen, the learning doesn't come the way it's supposed to. So now I find myself, my current situation is I'm in a building that reminds me of that other building that I just talked about. There are kids coming to school. They don't necessarily have everything they need that we would wish for them to receive outside of school. But my administrators are playing both sides of the fence. They're saying, hey, listen, this is school. Kids are here to learn. We're going to make that happen. Hey, listen, these kids are coming with some deficiencies. We're going to make that happen for them too. So take the time to love the kids. Take the time necessary to help the kid move in a pro-social direction. So if you see something happening that's wrong, take the time to show the care and compassion that's going to help this kid become a better person. And so you can imagine, I'm like a kid in a candy store. I'm like, I have a relationship with my administrators. I trust them both. I know they have a job to do, and I know I have a job to do, but I've just been given permission to care and show compassion for these kids, understanding that that is part of the formula in this building. They're going to need that in order for them to do well in mathematics, in order for them to pick up some of these concepts and to deal with this whole thing of growth mindset and what happens when you fail, because there's so much failure that we don't want these kids to just take that and make it normal. Oh, my whole life is a failure. So not understanding math, right on. It's just part of my profile. No, you come here. We care for you. We show you compassion. We build relationships. And yeah, you're going to fail a lot in math. But we're going to build a foundation. We're going to build you up in a way that there's capacity there for you to learn that we love you and we care for you, but that you're going to get through this math concept because you need it. We're not doing it for fun. I'm not putting you in situations to watch you fail because I'm some type of sicko. I'm there to help you learn. That's part of the learning process. So I can't say enough about that human side. And I know it because you've been working on the fringe of education since you started in education. And I can't imagine what would happen to you if you're working, you know, in your last role with suspended and expelled students and your immediate supervisor was in your face about curriculum all day long. Like, I can't even imagine what that's like. You have kids walk in who have just been kicked out of school. And you're like, yeah, we're not here for a relationship. You need to get through this curriculum. And you've got someone on your back about that. I can't imagine how that would operate. I just can't.
Gotta love the mute button. I love the fact that you included in there, because part of where you started, part of what you said in the beginning was that something to the effect of kids will find success or kids will be success. And I'm not sure if you're angling towards what I heard in this was that just to start that, you know, kids will find success or maybe more likely to find success. Let's say if we don't put barriers in front of them. And then the compassionate lens then is, if we're not putting barriers in front of them, that's cool. But the second part to that, are we lifting barriers that are already there? And that's really, you know, part of my, and I've only really connected the dots on this recently, is what the definition of compassion is for me, like where I find myself in demonstrating my compassion for the children that I work with. And one of the definitions that was brought to me, and it might be common, but it's new for me in my thinking, is the idea that compassion is the ability to kind of lift somebody else's burden. And I translate that into barrier. And I think that's where it becomes a little bit more of a, let's say, universal trait for people that work with kids, people that work with people. And also a bit of a bridge point between your Catholicism and what I would say my contemplativeness. So my mindfulness, like where we can sort of speak on the exact same page, you can bring some of the liturgy and the doctrine from your religious base, and I can bring it from mindfulness and some of the you know, some of the slow practice things that I consider in the middle of compassion is our ability, for me, my ability to not only not put barriers in the way of kids, which I do think in some ways will let them prosper, will let them be successful. And to a degree, as long as I'm working to not put barriers there, I would agree their kids are more likely to find a version of success for themselves. The second part to it, though, which becomes, I think, the necessary bookend to this is, am I actively seeking out, addressing, and working to break down the barriers that are there for each individual child in the school and in the people you're around, right? And this book, it puts forth, again, Emden puts forth the idea that one of the ways to do that is that you have to spend time in the community. Like, you really do. And there's, again, there's two steps to that. There's just the interest and curiosity to learn about the community that you work and you live and you connect with. But there's the counterpoint where you also have to be welcomed into that community to a degree so that you get the fullest story possible. So right away, we start to talk about how important trust and compassion are together as sort of symbiotic tools to build connectivity. And I'll take it back. There's a story you told. I think you told it in the space about, you know, the walking down the hall and just spending time with the kid that was sort of sitting on the floor in a hallway space and taking the time to work through that. Now, on one hand, I don't want to make this overly remarkable to a degree. My hope is, I'm glad you did it. My hope, maybe my naivete, is that more people do it. If we're not doing it, then there's an interesting conversation on the other side. Like, why is it that we don't stop in the hall to spend time in these moments? I mentioned at the tail end of in a session that I was trying to figure out, a colleague and I were trying to figure out what. So we did an equity presentation, and even as we're doing the presentation, we're still trying to figure out what our position within our presentation was, which was a really interesting bit of dissonance, because as we sort of provided our view of equity development in our school, and part of what we were speaking to was how do we bring students' authentic experiences, their lived experiences, into the classroom in a respectful way so that the kids feel like they're being represented in their own learning. Like, that's a long discussion, yo. Like, that's, we were sort of on point to deliver something. But even as we're discussing this, the talk that we were having, the presentation turned into a talk, which turned into a discussion, which turned into a little bit of a small, in some ways, kind of a trust session of talking about some of the challenges of actually building relationships with each other as adults and building relationships with students. And is that different? Do we go into school thinking about building these relationships of trust and compassion in a universal way? Do we look at our students? You say love. I agree with that. I don't often hear other extended discussions about how we love our students, how we love our colleagues, if that's a comfortable zone to talk about as well. But in the session, when we were talking about some of the real challenges, that if for some people, the trouble exists when they believe themselves to be a good person and building positive relationships outside of school. And then when they're in school, they feel like some of the rules are different. And vice versa, other individuals say, yeah, I quite easily make relationships with students. And I think it's the students are offering up parts of themselves. Like, I feel like I'm making positive gains there, but I don't use that outside of school. I'm very different outside of school. So with the trust and, let's say, the truth and the compassion, there's also this idea of kind of balance. Like, are we actually using whole self to get to know whole people? And this book is challenging me to consider some of the, I guess, well, it's biases, there's biases there, but some of the assumptions that I make in these interactions with students, despite the fact, as you pointed out, I've been working with students that could easily portrayed as being on the fringe of education. What I'm starting to accept, and this is where I have to change my language here, is that the students may be on the fringe of a system, but I'm not. And what's fascinating, this is the thinking that's kind of changing for me, is that that's privilege. Like, I'm choosing to kind of be in this space on what is perceived to be the edge of education, where some of these students feel like that's where they're hanging on. But I'm choosing to be there. And I'm trying to shift myself away from the language of existing on the fringe, because I really don't. I don't. I'm a part of this system where I'm choosing to be in this space in education. And I could leverage teaching a different subject. So I think I'm making a good choice. I'm making a good choice for me, where my interest in teaching is. Like, I'm making the right choice for me to sort of work in education as a career. But I still have work to do to fully appreciate what it means to be on the fringe from a student's point of view. And this book, in part, is bringing me to that discussion. But I don't have a clear way to be in that space. One of the parts that I'm looking at right now is why, and to what depth am I connecting with the community of whole people that exist in my school? And the school just happens to be the hub for the community, not the singular place to learn about the individuals that are in that school. So
you don't like it when people refer to you as working on the fringe?
I totally own it. Of course I like it. I like it because I do think to myself, they see me. They see me. This is where I've chosen to be. Where I'm starting to change and kind of like flow a little bit is that in that moment where I'm being seen, am I doing enough work to make sure that I'm also seeing my students? Like, if someone sees me being in that work, they do that probably based on either the assumptions, once they find out what I do, the assumptions about the type of work that I do, or I'm feeding them the line. I've fed people that line before. So where I'm kind of saying is, I own that, the fact that I've said to people before in attempt to articulate the type of work that I do, that I'm working on I kind of work in these fringe spaces, or I'm kind of, you know, others have mentioned, I think in early discussions with Hurley, he said what was kind of interesting about he and I sharing our point of view is that I kind of exist out there in a space that, at the time there weren't a lot of teachers going there, but really there's no badge for me on that. So unless I'm then repping exactly then what the experience of the students that exist in that space, and secondly, saying that I am choosing to be there, what we need to focus on is not on the fact that I'm willing to go there, is that the other students have no choice but to be there. And that's where I circle back to where you had said that students will find success. Yes, if we don't intentionally put barriers in front of them, but as a second layer to that, they will also more likely find success if we are actively pulling barriers that we perceive, that we see there, and spending the time to do it. Just like that kid in the hallway that you sat down and you had a conversation with about the tears that they were having. There's something that is keeping the kid in that moment, feeling those feels. And unless you're sort of, you know, pulling, you know, unless you're addressing the barrier that they perceive and pulling a barrier that maybe that they don't, that's where this book is pushing me. And there's no sure thing on this. There's no sure thing on this. And there's no way, like, there's no extra PD session coming from me trying to figure this one out. Instead, it's coming, flipping back to, I have a lot of doing to do. Like, I have a lot of sort of like road work. I got to put in some kilometers here to sort of figure out where I suck inside of my own theory. I have an understanding. I have a technical understanding of a process that I haven't test driven enough. So I got to spend some time on that. And I think last thing I'll say on this is also why I get, you know, some of the posts, it's not my experience to talk about how I am PDing myself into a state of perfection for September. It's not, I've gone there in some spaces before, and I've never really been able to sort of figure out what it is about it that just isn't me. But I think at the heart of it is that, as you said, if I share my inspiration list, it doesn't read as running. It doesn't read as having direct connection with education, but I find it inspires thinking about education. Some of the spaces that I like to listen to are like vehicles racing in parallel, but like sometimes with this wall between them, and you don't even realize that someone else is having an experience that can inform how you navigate this path. And the more I open myself up to that, I think the more weird I become in my teaching, because I feel inspired by an idea, I don't have the common tongue always to sort of EDU it. And I don't always have an EDU way to kind of bridge. I can't always find the bridge points. But some of the sources, whether it's my my podcast list, or some of the artists that I enjoy checking out, or some of the authors that I enjoy to read, it's almost like the crux of my whole person, which also includes teaching, needs to bring this stuff in to create balance around sometimes the imbalance that teaching, like in sort of like the resource suck that teaching can kind of create, and not always having a way. It's happened to me so often. Often my way of dealing with trying to get through a lesson in class that I might not have the textbook doctrine to work through is I'm drawing from stories from my lived experience away from school. So in the middle of sort of like these things that I experience away from school and the lesson I'm trying to work through with the kids, I'm drawing in, kind of filtering it through some of my, I guess it's imagined experiences, it's some of the lived experiences, it's my sort of personal paraphrasing of the things that I've done in my life. And I can't do that unless, I can't do that if I'm only compartmentalizing who and what I am in the classroom with EDU resources. I wouldn't flourish. I know that about me. I would not flourish.
I want to say that I've got big respect for the crew of people who, you know, have 5 or 6 books lined up for the summer and are going to be reading them about the work that they do and what they're going to do in September when the school year starts. But I also want to give big thumbs up to the people who don't operate that way, right?
That are just living. They're just doing stuff.
They're doing stuff.
And posting it on their previously EDU timelines. They're not redirecting you and say, hey, go check out my summer feed on Tumblr. It's just stuff that's popping up in their feed. Sorry, I'm pointing. But it's stuff that's just popping up in their feed. And I kind of dig that because I think to myself, look at them. They're checking out new stuff too.
I forget that we record the video of this podcast. So for my our listeners, I'm sorry that we keep doing stuff that you can't see because you're just listening. So the best experience, I guess, is to watch it because then you can see it and hear it. But whatever, do what you need to do. So big thumbs up to the people who have their reading lists and are ready to rock and roll with that. But big thumbs up to the people who aren't doing that either. You got to do what you got to do. And if your summer, the 2 months that you're away from the classroom means that you chill and you're not reading anything and you're just hanging out with your family or doing whatever you do, you travel, whatever it is you do, then you just do it. You just do it. Because I think as professionals, we all know we're coming back in September and we all know what that 10-month commitment entails. And it is a friggin' commitment. It's hard work. And there's no rest when you're in it. So do what you need to do. Chris, you wanna show me your drawing, or do you want to save that for the off ramp?
Yeah, I could do either, man. I could do either. You want to see?
I'd love to. Say something so that the picture comes off me.
Dice. That's it. I tried doing fuzzy dice.
It looks good, man. So for those of you who can't see it,
we have described what's that called? Described what's it called when it's not closed captioning? It's described
video.
Yeah, I dig that. Have you ever tried listening that to one time?
No.
Do it one time, man. It's pretty awesome. Like you listen to the described video, even on a short. It's totally disrupting. If we go back to where we start, using describe video, it's like giving you a tool that isn't necessarily right for you.
Cool.
It's that tech tool. Yeah, you try watching on a movie that you're familiar with, and you it's pretty distracting. But anyways, we did the describe video for our talk today.
Okay, so it's safe to say we probably are not going to be getting together next weekend and after the third week of Decoded Summer School, because you're going away and I'm going to be away. So hopefully we get back to the table sooner rather than later. But until then, Chris, enjoy your time away with your family. And I look forward to checking out some of the photos and your social media feeds on your adventures.
Cool, man. I'll chat you soon.
Yes, sir. Have a good one.
You too.